Appreciated that reading from Jeff. Appreciated all the songs that were led, the prayer and table talk class. I just feel like we've all been very encouraged and edified this morning by our worship and our study together. The church at Corinth has understandably gotten a bad rap. They just appear to be completely dysfunctional. I mean, they have serious divisions, or they had serious divisions. There's a man who had his father's wife. There was brother going to law against brother. Sexual morality. A carnal desire to stay connected to the carnal, idolatrous feast and the eating of meats that were sold in the meat market. Their assemblies were a mess. We can only imagine what they must have been like. Dealing with the rich, taking the Lord's Supper before the poor could get there. Competition over the use of spiritual gifts. In fact, 1 Corinthians 14 almost describes a chaotic situation where one person is speaking on top of the other. You can just almost imagine them nudging each other out of the front to address the congregation. There were even some who were denying the resurrection of the dead. It's surprising to see all of these issues in just one church, but there are a few things that we need to keep in mind before we judge them too harshly. First of all, 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 2 says that this is God's church. I've often felt that way in discussions about Peter. When we talk about Peter and his many problems, that's our brother, and Jesus died for him, and Jesus named him Peter and gave him a very important position in the early church. We need to be careful what we say about God's people. Secondly, we need to understand that this church was made up of people who were coming out of a very worldly lifestyle. Back in chapter 6, verse 9, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And then in verse 11, he just makes this comment almost in passing, and such were some of you. I can't even begin to relate what it's like to come out of a lifestyle that many of them came out of. And we have no idea how far they had come, how messed up they were when they first became Christians. We also need to remember that this is a very young church. If the church was established by Paul in 52 AD and he's writing to them in 55, these are all three-year-old Christians. And it takes a while to grow and mature. And I'm afraid that many of us have not made probably as much progress as they had in just a three-year period. So we need to be charitable in our judgments of them. They had written Paul a letter, and Paul apparently begins to respond to the questions that they were asking here in chapter 7, verse 1, where he says, now concerning the matters about which you wrote. And wherever we see a chapter or a new section begin with now concerning, it sounds like he's addressing another question. And wish we had the list of questions. We're listening to one end of a phone conversation, and we just kind of have to assume what the questions were. But whatever the questions were, they all appear to be very practical. Like, how am I supposed to live? Now that I'm a Christian, how does that impact my life directly? For example, do I need to remain celibate? Paul addresses that in chapter 7. What about if I'm married to a pagan? He addresses that as well. What about divorce? What about eating meat at the meat market, or even going into an idol's temple and sitting down and having fellowship with that? What about that? It kind of reminds me of some of the experiences I've had overseas with various churches that were very young in the faith. You always have a sermon or a class, and then after the sermon, you have the Q&A, and that can last sometimes longer than the sermon. And you're just peppered with, a lot of times, the same questions over and over again. For example, In the Philippines, one of the questions that we would inevitably be asked wherever we were was about balut. Balut is a delicacy over there where the chicken is still in the egg. And it's not like yolk. I mean, there's a chicken in there, and they intentionally eat it. And the question for the Christians is, this chicken has blood in it, and they would just eat it raw. So is that, and it's kind of gross, you know, but that was a thing. That was very relevant to them. Not something I've thought about much since I was in the Philippines, but it's something to them. And you realize when you're answering these questions over and over again, and you get tired of answering them, that the answer is important, right? Do I do this or do I not do this? Do I participate in this funeral service where there's ancestral type things that go on in Africa, or eating certain things in a strange culture that might be not appropriate? You need to give them an answer and give them a clear answer, but more important than that, you need to give them principles that they can use in answering any question that they might come across. And that's what you really want to spend time on, not just the answer, but how you get to that answer, so that they have the tools that they need for later answering other questions. That's really what we see Paul doing as he answers these various questions beginning in chapter 7, especially in chapter 7. We see him take an aside, and we're going to look at both of these in just a moment. He takes an aside from answering this list of questions he has in his hand to talking about the underlying principles that undergird the decisions that we make as Christians. He's really describing the Christian worldview, the way that we see ourselves, the way we see ourselves in the world, and the kind of perspective that we ought to have when answering any kind of question. And it's in these sections, not so much in the specific answers to questions, that we can find some of the most helpful things for us in the book of 1 Corinthians. And what he ends up doing in all of this is basically answering what matters. What matters? And what I'm going to do in my lesson, I've got the title slide and three more slides. In the next slide I'm going to show you all the things that Paul says don't matter. And that's actually a pretty long list. And then in the next slide, I'm going to show you the things that Paul says do matter. And that's a much shorter list, as you might expect. Most things don't matter. Now, it's not to say that there aren't right or wrong answers to these questions that they're asking. But what he does in answering these questions is really say, in some ways, you may be asking the wrong questions. And that's a lot of times the case. Paul takes until chapter 7 to get to the questions. He's already dealt with a man who has his father's wife. He's dealt with fornication, brother going to law against brother. They didn't ask him about those things, you know. And there's probably understandable reasons why they wouldn't. But they do want to ask these things, and he's pointing them back to the principles of how we determine what matters and what doesn't matter. Okay, so let's go through this list, and we'll make some applications at the end. First of all, Paul says that money doesn't matter. Now we're going to go back to chapter 6 just briefly and look at what he says when addressing this issue of brother going to law against brother. In verse 1, he says, "When one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints?" And here's the principle, verse 2. "Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases?" I don't know what verse 2 is talking about, but in some way, the saints, you and I, in the resurrection, we're going to judge the world. And so he says, if you can't judge these trivial cases regarding this life, how are we going to do that? Verse 3. This is even more bizarre. "Do you not know that we are to judge angels?" What in the world are you talking about, Paul? "How much more, then, matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle dispute between the brothers? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. And here's the question. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud even your own brothers. Do you hear what Paul's saying? What are you fighting over? What's this all about? Well, it's probably about pride. It's always about pride. But it's about money. And Paul's like, this is just money. Don't you realize who we are? Don't you realize our identity in Jesus Christ? Don't you realize how long eternity is and how short this life is? You're really going to go to law before unbelievers over money? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Another thing that he says doesn't matter, and talk about hitting two of our idols right off the bat, money and sex. Doesn't matter. Now, they're saying the same thing in a sense. They're saying, well, it doesn't matter what you do with your body. In a strange, twisted way, they may have been taking Paul's own words where he talks about Christian liberty and turning them against him. In verse 12, he says, all things are lawful for me. That may have been what he had taught them. And in my Bible, that's in quotes, as if to say that's what they are saying. All things are lawful for me, unquote, but, Paul says, not all things are helpful. And then, quote, all things are lawful for me, end quote, but I will not be dominated by anything. And here's the perspective he gives. Or no, this is the perspective they had. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food. You get the logic there? What's our stomach made for? It's made to eat food, and so eat it. What is the body made for? It's made for sex. And so it's natural. God has given us this. What's the big deal? Just do it with whomever you want to. There's no big deal about that. But notice how Paul comes back in the middle of verse 13, and God will destroy both one and the other. The body, Paul says, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And he says in verse 14, God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. These are not disposable bodies to just do with however we want to, use it up and then just toss it in the trash. No, our body is not our own, he's going to say at the end. Our body is for the Lord. He paid for our body with his own blood. He redeemed us. And he's going to come again, and the same Lord who rose from the dead is going to bring us up from the dead. So we can't just use our bodies however we want to. Verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual morality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body. The irony in this passage is that a lot of the sexual morality that went on in the city of Corinth was in idolatrous temples. And Paul comes back and says, look, in your culture, in the environment that you lived in, sex has been cheapened. It's even been made a religious part of worship. Paul says, think about who you are. Think about the fact that you were bought with a price, that you, your body, is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Your body is not for sexual morality. And, again, as he said about money, there's something much bigger that we're living for that goes way beyond this life. We're going to be raised someday. He also talks about food. We're going to skip chapter 7. I want to save chapter 7 for the end. He also talks about food when we come to chapter 8. In chapter 8, he begins again, now concerning food, offers to idols. Again, we don't know what the questions are, but we can assume based on the answer that it has something to do. Well, is it a sin? You know, that's how these questions often begin. Is it a sin to eat this food offered to idols? And many were saying, well, no, obviously not. Because this food, yes, it was offered in an idolatrous temple, idol's temple. And yes, there are some people who worship it, but we know better. We believe that there's one God. There aren't all these gods, and this meat, it's just meat. What's the big deal? I can eat it. I have the freedom and the liberty to do what I want. Because, you know, chapter 6, all things are lawful for me. And so I can eat this food. But Paul corrects their thinking, first of all, by rebuking their pride. Verse 8, now concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge, Paul says, puffs up, but love builds up or edifies. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he knows, he does not yet know as he ought to know, but if anyone loves God, he is known to God. And he goes on and explains, look, you're right. There's only one God. And this meat, in many ways, is morally neutral in the sense that it's just meat. But he says in verse 7, however, not all possess this knowledge. And he's talking about the conscience here. Not so much, I know that there's only one God. He's saying some people, their conscience will not allow them to eat this meat because they used to worship these gods. And so he says, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We're no better off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. What difference does it make to God? Why make an issue out of this? He's asking. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will you not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person has destroyed the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Money doesn't matter. Sex doesn't matter. Food doesn't matter. I mean, we've just hit three of our top idols, haven't we? And Paul's attacking each one, saying it doesn't make any difference. Think about who you are. Think about what Christ has done for you. Think about where we're going. And then come back and ask me, is it a sin to whatever? Think about these things as you answer these questions. He's giving them the principles that form the foundation to the Christian worldview. Does it matter? No, doesn't matter. It's of this world. Okay, so now we come to chapter 7. We're going to skip the questions about marriage because, again, that's not what this lesson is about. We spent a class, as Jeff taught us, 1 Corinthians, talking about the various possible assumed questions that they were asking about celibacy or marriage or divorce or whatever. But when we come down to verse 17, he's just said to those who are married to pagans that if your spouse is willing to live with you, the same rule that applies to someone married to a believer applies to you as well. Do not divorce. God's rule for anyone, whether they're married to a believer or an unbeliever, is the same. Don't divorce. However, we're not to be enslaved, is the term he uses, to the unbeliever. If they're just not willing to live with you and they go off, let them depart. Notice what he says in verse 17. This is where he hits the principles really hard. He says, only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? In other words, were you a Jew when you were baptized in the Christ? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised, the Gentile? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. What matters? Your ethnicity, the color of your skin, the language you speak, your nationality, none of that matters in Christ. It doesn't matter. You be content to live in whatever state you are when you are called. Realize who you are, and none of that other stuff matters. It doesn't define you. None of those things should define the child of God. We should be content with knowing that we're God's children, and we're just going to do what God says. We're going to do and obey His commandments. He also talks about freedom. Freedom. How important is freedom? Well, it's a wonderful thing. I'm thankful we have it. But freedom is not everything. Verse 20. Each one, he again repeats the principle, each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bondservant? Substitute the word slave there. The translators are sometimes hesitant to use the word slave, but that's what it is, doulos. Were you a slave or a bondservant when called? Do not be concerned about it. Oh, wait a minute, Paul. Don't you realize how slaves are treated in the first century? Don't you realize that there are a lot of masters out there? Yes, Paul knows all of that. In fact, he says in Colossians chapter 4 that masters should treat their servants justly and fairly. It means not everyone is treating their servants justly and fairly. Don't you realize, Paul, this is a serious problem? Yes, it's a serious problem. But what he says, he's not making light of their situation, understand. What he says is that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Verse 21, were you a slave? When called, do not be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. That's wonderful. That's a blessing. Paul was a free man. He, in fact, was a citizen, a Roman citizen, and he used that blessing. But that wasn't the center of his life. Verse 22, for he who is called in the Lord as a bondservant, is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is free when called is a bondservant of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants or slaves of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, let him remain with God. You notice the equality that we have in Christ? What is he about to say about the slave? He's really free. Don't see yourself as a slave. That doesn't define you. How your master treats you should not define your identity. It's how God sees you. You're a free man. And then he turns around and says to everyone who's free, all of you who are free, y'all are slaves of Christ. We're all in the same boat. We're all serving the same master. So don't be concerned about ethnicity. Don't be concerned about freedom. Those can be wonderful blessings that we can use, but it's not the center of our life. And then he says marriage doesn't really matter. And that's really one of the main themes of chapter 7, is that marriage just doesn't matter. He says in verse 25, now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Let me define some terms here. First of all, someone who is betrothed, it's something a little bit more than being engaged. In fact, those who are betrothed to each other, like Mary and Joseph, call each other husband and wife, though they were not yet fully married. And so what about those who, he's already addressed celibacy, and he's already addressed those who might unfortunately be divorced and given the rules, and he's all along elevated this idea that there's a reason why it might be better for you to remain single. But what about those who are betrothed? What about those who are engaged, as we would say, to be married? Well, he says, I don't have a clear, direct statement from the Lord. And that's what's so frustrating about answering questions sometimes. We'd like to just flip our pages and point to the book, chapter, and verse, and here it is. There it is, the clear answer. It's not always clear. Not even to an apostle. I feel comforted by that. But he says, I give my judgment based on the principles that I know all Christians ought to make, all decisions. I'm going to give my judgment as one to whom the Lord has deemed trustworthy. He says in verse 26, I think that in view of the present distress, we don't know what that was. Was it persecution? Was it a famine? Some epidemic or something? I don't know. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. What does he mean? Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. That would be a sin. That would be divorced. Remain in that condition. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. He already said at the beginning of the chapter that if you can't control yourself sexually, it would be better for you to get married because you don't want to sin because you're not married. And so go ahead and get married. But if you can control yourself, it's better to remain single. Why? Because of this present distress, whatever it is. He says in verse 28, but if you do marry, you have not sinned, and if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you from that. Now we can just kind of assume what's the situation. Let's say that there was persecution going on. And let's say that you're Stephen, right? Stephen may have been a deacon, may have had a wife and children, right? And you realize what I'm preaching right now may cost me my life. But it's not just that simple, is it? Because when I die, what's going to happen to my wife? What's going to happen to my kids? And you see how that might be a temptation for you to compromise your faith in Jesus Christ. Or worse still, and this went on, even in the first century. If they say to you, okay, we're going to kill you, but before we kill you, we're going to take your wife and children and kill them in front of you and make you watch it. And then we're going to kill you. I mean, I don't know that's what the present distress was, but Paul's saying, I want you to be without care. That's the reason I'm giving this advice as one whom the Lord has judged trustworthy. He says in verse 29, this is what I mean, brothers. Let me explain this. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no possession, no goods. And those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the present form of this world is passing away. He's just hit a couple other categories. Not only does marriage not matter, circumstances don't matter. If you're happy, don't act like you're happy. If you're sorrowful, don't act like you're sorrowful. I mean, he's not being callous, and he's not contradicting what he said in Romans chapter 12, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. He's not meaning to sound like, well, it just doesn't matter, just buck up and go on with your life. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, I want you to realize that there's something much more important than these present distresses that you're going through, whatever the circumstances are, financial, health, whatever. There's something way more important than that. And possessions. Those who buy as though they do not possess. That thing you bought at the market last week that you've been saving up for, forget about it. Forget about it. It doesn't matter. There's something way more important for you. He says in verse 32, I want you to be free, your translation may say, from care. Mine says anxieties. I don't want you to be fearful. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. You hear what he's saying in this chapter? He's really said two things that are virtually the same. What matters? It's none of those other things. It's keeping the commandments of the Lord, keeping the commandments of God. Doesn't matter whether you're circumcised, uncircumcised, Jew, Gentile, slave, free, doesn't matter. What matters is you keep the commandments. That's what matters. Don't obsess over things that don't matter. Be concerned about the things that do matter, and keeping the commandments of God is what matters. And as he said about the unmarried man, he's not saying that celibacy is more holy or virtuous. I know there's all kinds of false teaching in the religious world about that. That's not what he's saying. He's saying under these present circumstances, it might be better for you to remain single so that you can maintain this undivided focus on the Lord. You want to please the Lord. It's more important than anything. It's not that we don't want to please our wives. You know, he's not contradicting what he said in Ephesians chapter 5 about husbands loving their wives. He's just saying there's something even more important than marriage. And that's pleasing the Lord. And so let's look at these things and make some applications. What does this mean to you and me? How should this change our lives? Well, one thing, when you look at this list on the left side of the screen, whether it be money or sex or food or ethnicity, freedom, marriage, circumstances or possession, those are the kinds of things that we can sometimes compete over. Are they not? Do we not compare ourselves to others and look around like we were talking about with Joseph this morning and his brothers? Do we not look at ourselves and say, well, why does he have a coat? Yeah, I don't have a coat like that. Do we not do that? Especially with those that we see as our peers. And the closer we are to them, the more likely we're going to be tempted to compare ourselves. And so we don't envy those who have these things. We don't look at our brothers and sisters especially, or at anyone in the world, and say, well, I guess they think they're better than me because they're married and I'm not. Or they have kids and I don't. Or they have a problem-free job or a well-paying job or that big old house or anything. We can use anything. And it can become a tool for Satan to drive and wedge us apart and cause all kinds of problems. And it's really one of the most selfish things that we can do, because when we are envying someone else, we are despising the gifts of God. I mean, we can maybe look at Jacob and say, well, you really shouldn't have given Joseph that coat of many colors. But can you do that to God? Can we do that to God? If I despise what you have and wish you didn't have it, I'm despising the gifts that God gave you. And so my problem is not really with you, it's with God. And so we don't allow those things to burden us or cause us anxiety or worry or envy. And we don't feel superior around those who lack these things. Again, there's an equality. The one who is a slave is to see himself as a freedman. The one who is free is not to look down on his brother who is a slave, but rather say, I'm a slave, just like you. I'm a slave with you. We're all slaves of Christ. And so there's an equality there. It's easier for us to accept the loss of these things. So what if we lose our job? It's just a job. So what if we lose our marriage? And I'm not talking about divorce, although that is tragic. I'm talking about death. And I don't say this lightly. I know that this is a painful subject for some of you, all right? But I want you to think about this when you think about marriage. We talk about and emphasize the permanence of marriage. Do you realize that marriage is a temporary relationship? It's what Jesus said in Matthew 22. He said, in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels. Marriage is a temporary relationship. We even say that in our vows. Until death, we do part. That's not the center of our life. The center of our life is God. Our life is hid with Christ in God. You have died. Everything that is part of your life has died. And now we have a single-minded focus on pleasing the Lord. And so we can accept the loss of even the most precious things God has given us. Because we don't worship those things. They're simply gifts from God. And then finally, none of these things are to interfere when it comes to our service to God. And they can so easily. We can make idols out of any of them and exalt them. Even the good things like family, our wife or our husband or our children. And those things can become ahead of the Lord. You know, sometimes we say things like, my marriage is everything. Or my children, they're the most important things to me. Or if you have your health, you have everything. Christians don't speak that way. That's not the way we view the world. These are blessings. I am thankful to God every day for my wife, for my children, for my health, for my house, for the financial security that we have. All of these things are blessings from God, but they are not to be worshipped. They are not the center of our life. And that's what Paul is trying to help the Corinthians to see and by extension, what he's trying to help us to see. And so what about you? What's the center of your life? Only you can answer that. I mean, there's been a lot of things going on this last several months, last week. A lot of stuff. And it really is disturbing and it's concerning. And we should be concerned. And let me say this before I'm misunderstood. God is concerned. He's so concerned about what's going on in the world today that someday the Lord is going to come back and judge all wickedness. God cares about justice. No one cares more about justice than God does. No one cares about the souls of all these who are suffering because of various things that are going on in the world, whether they be health or political or whatever. No one's more concerned than God is. But we've just got to block all of that out at times. I'm not saying we're not concerned, and we should be concerned. We got to have this laser-like focus on what matters. And don't allow the current events, whatever they are, and they seem to be always changing from week to week. Don't allow these to paralyze us and to grip us and to hold us back from serving the Lord. So what about you? Do you realize that you do have some idols in your life you need to get rid of? Well, then make that right. And it may not involve coming forward, but it may just involve you, as we stand and sing, praying right where you are, asking the Lord to help you with these idols. It may be that you need our help, and that's what we're here for. Maybe in a public way, maybe privately after talking with us. Or it may be that it's time for you to finally commit to the Lord and confess Him before men, repenting of the idols that you've worshipped and finally submitting your life to Him, and you can be buried with Him in baptism. So whatever you need, you have. Why don't you come as together we stand and sing.